COVID-19, the Ukraine war, and extreme weather events have created ongoing disruptions globally and locally, with knock-on effects for New Zealand's dairy sector. But with the challenges come opportunities. Today, you'll get some food for thought on what's ahead for our sector. The bigger picture stuff that'll influence what's happening with costs, labour supply, milk price, and so on. Our guests are Melissa Clark Reynolds, who's a foresight practitioner. And don't worry, we'll explain what that means soon. And Mark Storey, Dairy NZ's Head of Economics. Melissa is an expert at spotting trends before they emerge. She'll talk about some of the things she's seeing on the horizon that could affect dairy, plus how long the impacts of current global disruptions could last and where the opportunities are for our sector, if we're open to them. Meanwhile, Mark will bring some insights on the cost pressures being felt by farmers, what's coming, and what dairy farmers might focus on in the short to medium term and beyond. Keep an eye out for Dairy NZ's two Farmers Forum events, where Melissa and other speakers will continue this topic and more. This year's Farmers Forum at Karapiro in the Waikato on Thursday 27th April and in Ashburton on Tuesday 9th May will have a strong focus on science and research, helping you continue to farm successfully in the future. Let's get into it. Mark and Melissa, thank you so much for your time today. This is excellent to have you on the podcast. Melissa, let's get started with you. Tell us, what is a foresight practitioner and what sort of insights are you able to gain that may affect our sector?
I used to jokingly say that I did tarot cards for corporates. And then one day I was in the States, actually on a Te Hono primary sector trip, and I said this jokingly to someone and she was like, oh my God, so do I. And she really did. And so I've stopped saying that. But I think what I like to do is that I'm really good at pattern recognition. And if we think about pattern recognition, what that allows you to do is look at patterns in the past and think about how they might play out in the future, or patterns in other industries and how they might play out. And so I've trained at the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto. I've trained with a guy called Sahel Niatola, who's one of the world's best futurists. And then I've also trained at the School of International Futures, which is really about thinking about community involvement in creating futures. And I have this weird background. I did a mixture of anthropology, and then I went back and did epidemiology and environmental studies. So I like math a lot, but I also really like people. And I think as a foresight practitioner, what you're really thinking about is that convergence of human behaviour and what is the data telling us. And so for me, I spend a lot of my time in the food and fibre sector. About 80% of my company's work is thinking about the future of food and fibre. And my last little bit of intro, I suppose I would say, is that if we look around the present is already like messy and contradictory. And the future will be too. And I think what we often want is we want to hear that there's one future out there. But there isn't, you know. I didn't look in the fridge here at Dairy NZ, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's someone here who doesn't drink milk, you know. And that doesn't mean that the future is all non-milk drinkers. It doesn't mean that the future is all milk drinkers. Do you see what I mean? But I feel like as humans, we want to sort of pick one thing and say, ta-da, the future's going to be like that. But one of the things I'd like people to take away from this session is that the present is messy and contradictory, and the future will be too.
Mm. I don't know if you were going to get to this further on, but you talk about signals.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you could just explain now what that means?
Yeah, probably a good chunk of my day job is watching for signals. And what I mean by those is that there's this idea that the future is all around us, but it's just not evenly distributed. And if you look around, you can often find the outliers for things. So something might have started 30, 40, 50 years ago that today we go, wow, it's everywhere. It's incredible. It was really fast. But most changes, whether they're technological or social, they happen slowly, slowly, gradually, gradually, and then suddenly. And so if we're paying attention, we can look around and find things that look like they might turn out to be the future, and we can use those to give us insight. So I know this is going to seem like a weird one, but I'll give you an example, which is that, I went to St. Matthew's in Masterton. There were six of us in my last year at school. I really wanted to learn to code, and that wasn't a girl's subject, so I got bused to Rathkeel. And now, of course, there's the whole senior college where, you know, you can do a combined years 12 and 13, but that didn't really exist. And so I got bused out to Rathkeel. I was the first year at Rathkeel that we did coding, and we didn't have a computer in the school. And I can remember quite a few people saying to me, like, this can't really be a thing. This isn't going to be a thing. And my school guidance counsellor convincing me not to take code at university because it wasn't really a thing. And they weren't wrong. They were right. It wasn't a thing. But it turns out it was going to be a thing. And so these little signals where, you know, okay, so the school started teaching coding, even if we had to mail our code to someone who owned a computer, you know. But you think about the way that we teach in schools now, you think about how schools managed to pivot to being online during the pandemic. They couldn't have done that if they hadn't had that kind of experience 50 years ago or whatever, 40-odd years ago back at Rathkeel and St Matthews. See what I mean? And one of the difficult things with signals is we don't know when they're going to turn into something. So some of them might just turn out to be dead ends, or some of them might emerge. I spoke at a Dairy NZ farmers event maybe 5 years ago, and it was when the beginning of plant-based meat was sort of starting to be talked about. And I remember just thinking, who's going to eat this stuff? And it's so easy for us to look at things and kind of mock whatever we don't understand. But I've just kept watching it as it's evolved. And, of course, it's not the thing it started out as, which was sort of pink slime, you know. It's actually over those 5 years, the price points come down, the palatability has gone up, the marketing processes are there, the demand from consumers has changed. And that's the thing about watching the signals. At the beginning, kind of often they look ridiculous. And then over time, some of them die. But a good chunk of them turn out to be the way the world is. So signals, but they're not hunches. I want to be clear about that. A signal is an actual thing, like it might be an actual product. Or we can think about, you know, when podcasts became popular, the radio had been popular for a long time. So you couldn't have podcasts without radio. But who knew podcasts were going to be such a great thing, and that we'd be, I don't know, sitting on the farm, or I'd be out with my bees, or we'd be doing something and I'd be listening to some expert.
So it's interesting. So you're looking for a pattern emerging before it becomes a trend.
Yeah.
You know, where everyone says, oh, there's a trend here, but you're actually looking for those trends.
And I kind of lose interest when it's a trend. And then what I'm interested in is when the trend's going to die. But I'm most interested, in those actual things that occur before the trend. Mm. Because that's what we can do something with if we're anticipating the sector or where things might go.
Fascinating. So, Melissa, let's talk about the big events of COVID-19, the Ukraine war, and extreme weather. What effects have these had at a global and local level? I know that's a big question, but I'll pitch it to you.
I guess way backing up the truck is that I think about the pandemic having been caused by two things converging, and in many ways, it's not necessarily a popular opinion, but we could think about it as being a food process failure. So I studied climate medicine in 1989, and in 1990 I wrote a report for the Ministry of the Environment that said that last year would be the year that Nelson would be underwater and we'd have a pandemic. But the pandemic I thought it was going to be was dengue fever. We wrote quite a lot of reports back then about what we knew about climate change, what we knew about the expansion of animal agriculture, and what those two things coming together in particular might mean for new diseases. So if we back right up, you can tell if you can see me that my family, I whakapapa to the north, right? I come from those wildlings over the wall, right? So my DNA is pretty much Scottish. And if you're Scottish, you pretty much got a bunch of Viking in there because the Vikings, you know, the Danes occupied for a long time. Now, we spent something like 10, 15,000 years sharing our homes with our animals. So my DNA has got a whole lot of long-term, what we call epigenetics. So my genetics have changed because my family literally slept in the barn with the animals. So my resistance to cow diseases or my resistance to sheep diseases or goat diseases is surprisingly high. very, very different than if you look at some DNA of someone who evolved, you know, their family came whakapapa back to Polynesia. They didn't do that, right? Mm. So very, very different farming practices. And those farming practices meant that we became more resistant to all kinds of poxes and all sorts of stuff, right? As we expand animal agriculture into China and into South America and in Indonesia and other places, we are clearing forest. And what we're doing is we're bringing mammals into contact with each other in ways that they've never done that before. And we've been writing about this for about 30 years, okay? So you would expect if you put cows in South American rainforest that there are going to be monkey diseases that are going to come in those cows at some point because they're not used to being together. And on the 23rd of January 2020, I read the first genomic analysis of the SARS virus, this one, this current. So what is the COVID-19 virus? And back on the 23rd of January, we knew that there was a very clear path of genetic change between a bat, a pangolin, and a human. And I started then looking at things like mink farming. And the reason that we're very interested in minks is that they're indoor agriculture, the north again, right? So the Danes do a lot of it. And the respiratory system of a mink is very similar to ours. And so early on, I predicted that we'd have to do massive mink culls. I'm watching mink now for avian flu because we're seeing quite a lot of the H1N1 virus in minks. I know this isn't necessarily where you thought this whole thing was going to go. But what I can say is that we were trained to think of this as pandemic century. And a lot of it is to do with the way we practice agriculture around the world combined with climate change. Okay, so we knew these pandemics were coming. There are going to be more. I watch them every day, right? So there's that one piece. They will be here to stay. This isn't a kind of a, right, we're done, it's over now. On top of that, what we found is that the Imperial College of London put out some reports very early on that said that the best thing you could do for the economy would be to eliminate this virus. And so the way to eliminate the virus would be to do short, sharp lockdowns, stop transmission and kill it off. Now, what you had, of course, was that you had a very small number of countries, four really, that took that bit of advice seriously and had a crack at it. And those countries, interestingly, including New Zealand, had the strongest economies during the height of the pandemic. What happened, of course, is we've had massive pressure to open up the economy and to have people go back to work. 40 people died last week, you know, unconscionable for the first 2 years of the virus to have 40 people die in a week. And what it's also done is that as we've opened up those economies, what we've found is that the economies that were most open have had the worst performance in the sort of post-intense pandemic process. So we think we've got high inflation. We've got one of the lowest bits of inflation in the OECD. So it's no fun for us, but it is still quite low. And then you layer on top of that the war in Ukraine. And to me, the big things that worry me there is, again, in our supply chain. So we've seen massive impact in terms of grain prices globally, and we've seen, you know, massive prices in terms of energy changes. And so I'm looking at those, but I think probably a lot more of my work has been, you know, watching things like we've had a Japanese encephalitis outbreak in Australia. Does that turn into something? One of the best things that happened to New Zealand pre-COVID was the African swine fever global pandemic that killed pork and that raised global demand for all proteins like dairy and meat. So pandemics are not necessarily bad for us. And I know that sounds like a weird thing to say, but most of my work in the last 10 years has been on animal pandemics rather than human ones, because that's what's been the most interest to the food and fibre sector.
To what level should farmers, and specifically dairy farmers, be thinking about these kinds of things, these big picture things? And is there anything they can actually practically do in their day-to-day farming?
I think that one of the ones that is going to practically affect us is around the global supply chains for supplementary feed. And I think that's one that we can think about quite a lot. And as I said, you know, the present is messy and contradictory. And so, you know, we can talk about volume versus value. We can have those conversations. We have to understand that, you know, palm kernel has come out of areas that are whether, you know, we think we contributed directly to deforestation or not. There's a lot of discussion around deforestation and palm kernel. And equally, I've seen a fair chunk of people converting to soy. That soy is coming out of areas of South America where there's big discussions about deforestation. So I think understanding our place in the global supply chain makes a big difference. You may not be able to do a huge amount about that if you're committed to, you know, you've got the debt you've got on your land, you have to produce the kind of volume that you have to produce. So I'm not saying that you should change your farming practices, but I think that you have to understand that the costs of your inputs are affected by these global patterns and will continue to be. Yeah, but I think, you know, climate change, we kind of can't get away from now, no matter whether we're farming in the Hawke's Bay or farming somewhere else. That discussion has been coming for a long time, and we are going to have to continue to have that conversation about what it, not just what it means to try and prevent climate change, but also how do we adapt and what does it mean to farm in an era where we have such volatility.
I'm going to come back to you, Melissa. I'm going to shift to Mark for a while, and I think it flows on quite nicely. But Mark, looking at what's sort of coming in the next year, how do you see the dairy sector faring, you know, where the domestic economy, as I understand it, is forecast to enter a recession or at least a slowdown? What are the cost pressures that are of most concern to farmers at the moment?
Well, at the moment, cost pressures are high in terms of farm working expenses, so higher than they've been historically for some time. In particular, fuel and fertilizer, feed costs, labor costs at the moment, and with interest rates where they are, the cost of borrowing. So we've seen, we're forecasting this current season that farm working expenses, farm working costs will be increased by 11% on the previous year, and they're an increase from that year, et cetera. So they've been going up for some time. The main thing that's driving those increases for this coming season, this is all forecast, but feed costs at 21%, fertilizer at 28%, and notably interest costs at 39%. Probably top of mind for many farmers right at the moment and for many New Zealanders and businesses are rising interest rates and obviously costs of borrowing that are associated with it.
I just want to say, Melissa, if as we're having this conversation, if you want to jump in with any questions for Mark and vice versa, please go for it.
Oh, no, okay. I just couldn't agree more. And I didn't mention fertilizer in terms of the impact that Ukraine and that war has had on that. But, you know, if you push up the price of gas production and push up the price of any of the kind of fossil fuel related industries, and so much of our fertilizer has come from fossil fuel related industries. I should have mentioned that. But, you know, my heart goes out. It must be really hard farming under these conditions.
And continuing, the Reserve Bank recently increased the OCR again. How's the dairy sector expected to fare in the face of rising interest rates?
Yeah, my answer here is probably a little bit double-sided. There's a cautionary note and a positive note. Obviously, interest rate costs, farmers are feeling that squeeze, as are most business owners and many, you know, households in New Zealand. The OCR rate, cost of borrowing more than doubled in the past couple of years, and farmers are seeing that come through into their budgets. The good news story in there is that the sector as a whole is much better placed than it was 5 to 6 years ago. So, you know, back in the 2016-2017, we saw banks putting quite a lot of pressure on farmers to pay down their debt. That was tough at the time, but we're seeing some of the benefits of that now. Overall, debt levels in the sector, in the dairy sector, have decreased from $41.7 billion in 2018 to $36.5 billion in 2022. So debt's come down. That's an overall picture. This doesn't mean that some individual farmers aren't really facing the squeeze. They clearly are. That picture differs quite a lot by region and by the type of farmers. So, you know, leverage ratios are different in different parts of the country. As you would expect, younger farmers and new entrants will be more leveraged than more established farms. So they will be feeling the squeeze in these times more than others. So the picture's a little bit mixed. If we focus on the positive, though, debt levels have come down to a degree. In terms of looking ahead, the trajectory for interest rate costs is we sort of know where it's going. We never know with 100% certainty where it might end up. But if it follows forecasts, you know, we're not far from it peaking. And farmers, if they continue to manage their budgets carefully, should be in a reasonably good position to come out of this.
Mm. You've previously commented that dairy as a sector came through the pandemic relatively well compared to some other sectors. Why was that? I mean, we obviously know some of the reasons, but I'd love to get you to sort of flesh that out for us. And are the problems caused by the pandemic behind us now?
You know, the issue with how we came through the pandemic is, fortunately, you know, the demand, international demand for dairy held up pretty well, and so did international prices. That meant that we continued to get good, you know, good return for our exports during that period. There was good revenue coming into the country. So overall, based on the way that the market held up for milk products, the sector came out through the pandemic well, and so did the New Zealand economy, partly based on that. Probably the most difficult thing, well, one of the most difficult thing for the sector during the pandemic was obviously managing farmers' well-being, their workers' well-being, but labour costs and the ability to, you know, have access to labour units during that period. We're still seeing the ongoing effects of that now. It's not all down to the pandemic by any means, but that was one of the main financial squeezes from the pandemic on farmers. Looking ahead, are the effects of the global pandemic behind us? Yes and no. We're definitely in a post-COVID recovery phase now. I guess the legacy of COVID that we're facing now is inflationary pressures. So governments spent a lot to come through the pandemic phase. And the legacy of that now are the high inflation rates, which many central banks in many countries are grappling with. New Zealand's not alone in that context. Most OECD countries are facing it. There's a bit of an ongoing debate around now whether that corner has been turned in countries such as the United States, where the central banks are getting on top of it, and whether it's kind of the post-COVID expenditure which is driving that inflation or other factors. But I think we can look ahead with some optimism that inflation coming out of the COVID period, you know, we're getting on top of it, but time needs to run its course yet. The other note of optimism, I guess, coming through this is China, and China kind of taking its place again in the global market post-COVID, maybe happening a little bit later than we were hoping, and sort of be seeing exactly how China will come through that period. But as China re-emerges and takes its place in global markets again, it's a good story, if you like, for demand for milk products and effectively the returns that New Zealanders can expect from dairy in the future. So we watch with interest what happens in China in the next few months, year. Mm.
Can I jump in? There's just sort of two things I'd really like to support in there. Again, one of the first signals that I put out to my clients, who include some quite big players in the dairy industry, was on February 7th of 2020, two things happened. One of them was that the first of those whistleblower doctors died. And on the same day, China ran out of shipping containers. And that was because of the impact that was already being had in China of the pandemic. And so what I think is really interesting is that we've had, you know, this 3 years of supply chain disruption. And so a big, again, piece of the work that I do is I work with a number of the supply chain providers in the primary sector, particularly ones who move dairy around. And, you know, what we've seen is that we've had to move a lot more to air freight. We've had massive disruptions to ports globally. A good chunk of that has just been how sick and unwell port workers have been. What we also saw in the US was the meat industry fight to be called an essential industry and then not have to provide good care for their staff, and then, not surprisingly, find that their staff couldn't come to work because they were sick. We've taken over 1 million workers out of the American economy in this last period, and that is part of what we don't always think about when we think about the global labour crunch, but they've died, right? So when we, you know, we've got to think about that. And then in the tech industry that I live in, so much of that occurred in Ukraine and other places. 200,000 coders have been taken out of the global economy in Ukraine, you know. So these are global labour issues, right? Plus, I think some of the disruption in supply chain is still here for a while yet, because there are still, you know, whether we see climate events in the Northeast over Christmas, we saw big blizzards affecting New York and Philadelphia ports. We've had threatened strike action in Long Beach for some time in California, a lot of that to do with working conditions during the pandemic. I just think that there are still some of these things, and I don't want to be depressing about them, just saying that there's some of these headwinds for the sector. Now, farmers won't necessarily see the impact of that, but they'll see it perhaps in their share price, or they'll see it perhaps in what the costs of goods sold are and the companies that they supply, because I think we're still going to see some headwinds in global labor shortages in this whole supply chain. But, you know, I sit on a meat company where we're air freighting everything we can again at the moment because we're based in the Hawke's Bay, right? The other good side that I just really agree with Mark on around the pandemic is what happened is that when people are unwell, they truly believe that protein will help them get better. And so what we saw was a cultural demand for more protein of every sort, including dairy globally, during the pandemic. And so I'm just curious to see if we are post-pandemic, you know, whether any of that demand will drop off. And at the moment, we're not really seeing it except under price pressure. But I think there's a few of those things that come together in a really interesting way. So the world is way more complex. Yeah. We like to make it, you know, but I just really agree with everything Mark said. Mm.
I don't know if this is a dumb question or if you can answer this, but how do we know when we're no longer in post-COVID recovery? Like, what does that look like?
Well, I don't think there's any normal that we're going back to. So, but, you know, for one, I think we can try and pretend that things are right, but 40 people still dying last week is not normal, you know. We are the only country in the world that has negative excess deaths over the 3 years. So what that means is that New Zealand, and during lockdown, what we actually achieved was we achieved a massive decrease in the number of deaths from all causes, which was pretty rare. So mental health deaths went down, cancer deaths went down, road deaths went down, like every form of death went down. In 2022, we went up and we actually had more deaths than you would expect. But the cumulative over the 3 years, we're still in negative death, you know? So for me, I know it sounds weird, but one of the ways I think we'll know we're back to normal is that the normal level of people are dying. Wow. I know it's not very cheerful, but that's from the epidemiologist's point of view, right? But I don't think we had a discussion as a country. Like, we've talked a lot about mental health, and I do believe that there were some huge stresses of lockdown. But what we know was that teenagers found it better. They liked having people at home. Like, the stress levels were different in 2021 than they were in 22. We can't necessarily think about them being the same all the way through. So I don't know, how are you going to tell when it's actually properly over as opposed to us declaring it over?
You know, I'm not sure, you know, that'll be like a historical point perhaps where we can think, you know, when have we moved from a post-COVID recovery into economic situations which have actually been driven by other factors that have come along in the meantime. But certainly one of the legacy effects of COVID is inflation. And, you know, that inflation is with us for some time yet. So, you know, one indicator might be when those inflation levels start to drop. And I guess in that context, in the New Zealand situation, we see the impacts of things like Cyclone Gabrielle, and, you know, that will potentially be feeding into inflationary pressures in terms of the rebuild, wage price inflation. We've still yet to see maybe that play out in New Zealand and what that might mean for the New Zealand economy. So there's a fairly long way to go yet to get into a post-COVID world, and other things will come along into play which could push us in either direction. Of course, you know, global milk prices can go any way. There's lots of things, conflicts in different parts of the world. There's lots of weather events, lots of things that can push us different directions. But inflation will be, is definitely one of those indicators.
Yeah. You mentioned Cyclone Gabrielle. Do you expect that the cyclone's effect will have a significant impact on our total milk production this season?
No, not for dairy sector in particular. I should caveat that we haven't, I'm not really in a position yet sort of give the full detail of what the impact on dairy production might be. In the regions affected, it's significant. But we do know that dairy is probably less affected than some of the other key sectors. Horticulture and fruit growers who have really been hard hit. Dairy has been less hard hit in those sectors, in those regions. If you look at it across the economy, as is nearly the case in any weather event, often over the course of a year, reductions in production in one part of the country may be offset by reasonably good growing conditions in other parts of the country, and I expect the season won't be much different. So if we do see a drop in production, I wouldn't predict it to be significant. But, you know, caveating that by the fact that actually the impact on dairy farmers and other, of course, primary producers in those regions is really tough. It's not just the impacts on production for those sectors, it's the ongoing costs of infrastructure, which is down, getting feed and roading costs, uncertainty, obviously stress and well-being. The economic impacts and the well-being impacts are significant, but the story for the sector as a whole probably will come through okay, as is often the case with an extreme weather event. We don't often sort of see it flying through into a significant dip in production overall.
Okay. A question for both of you. What do you think that dairy can do to increase its resilience to extreme weather events?
I think amongst others, we have to think about location, you know, and we have to think about that differently. I think I lived in Christchurch when the earthquakes happened down there and, you know, I was from Wellington and it never occurred to me that I would be going to an earthquake zone, right? And came back to Wellington to live and I remember friends mocking me. It's like, go to Wellington to escape earthquakes, you know. But it's the same. I don't think we really thought about the Hawke's Bay in the way that we are now. Certainly Thames Coromandel, you know, it's been flooding for years. It's been under mud pretty much every winter. You know, you sort of, that to me was less of a surprise, but that huge impact on Esk Valley and others, and I know there are people who've been talking about this for some time, but I think we do have to think about location. NIWA has been putting reports out for 30 or 40 years now talking about where inundation will most affect, where climate change and particularly sea level rise will most affect, and I think we do have to be actually having some good hard looks at land use and where that land use is. And it's not going to be an easy transition, but I think that it is time for us to be really deeply thinking about how we fund that transition, and that will be inflationary as well. So not only the funding, the cleanup, but we are going to have, as a nation, we're going to have to think about how we fund transitions for not just for farming, but for horticulture, for people who own land on the edges. Mm. You know, we've done a lot of work in the dairy sector around water quality. We've done a lot of work around braided rivers. We've done a lot of work around planting and catchment quality. I think what we've seen is that that may not be enough fast enough. And so I think we are going to have to accept that our catchment groups are going to need a lot more support. There's nothing they could have done about the amount of silt or slash that's come down, but they are going to have to think about, is this now a floodplain? Just like these 100-year weather events, we have to expect that they're going to become more and more frequent. You know, the data's been showing us that for a very long time.
Mm. Mark?
Yeah, I guess to sort of reflect, you know, the farming sector and primary industry sectors deal with volatility all the time. They're participating in a very, you know, in an international market. Prices are going up and down. They're continually planning for volatility and uncertainty. And they've had to do that in terms of their financial planning, in terms of what's going to happen with future dairy prices, et cetera. Weather events like this add another layer to that. So I guess it's about planning and building for change and for volatility and unexpected events. You can build that into your farm budgets and into your planning to a degree. There's one answer, sort of like, you know, this season, prepare for a drought, prepare for a flood. You may need to do a bit of both. Mm. And farmers obviously have been preparing in some cases, in some regions there, for drier summers. And you might be coming along sort of thinking, well, you know, you also need to prepare for a particularly wet one, as we've had this year in some regions. The question about building more resilient agriculture is both is a tricky one or a complex one in terms of building for, you know, the ongoing effects of climate change that we're expecting to see. So, you know, we obviously expect partial growing conditions to begin to vary in the country. Preparing for extreme weather events like we've seen is another kettle of fish again. Dairy NZ, in terms of that work we're doing to try and build more resilient farming operations, it's work that's been done. It's work that farmers will need to continue to do. But it's extremely challenging preparing for those kind of extreme weather events if one in 50-year events or one in 100-year events, if they start to come every 2 to 3 or every 10 years, then we've got some really big decisions to make around location, around infrastructure investment, and around insurance.
Yeah.
I was wondering, because you work in other sectors, you know, are you having similar sort of conversations?
I'm mostly having this conversation in this sector. I think in other sectors, what's interesting is that, so I've just done a big project with the Ministry for the Environment on their long-term insights briefing, and I've been working a bit with Auckland Council prior to the flood. And I think, you know, one of the areas I'm seeing, and I mentioned like community futures, one of the things that I'm really excited about is seeing us think about what the role is of local government, what is the role of central government, what are they for, what do we want them to do? And I think as a country, we haven't necessarily had some of those deep conversations about what is it. So like do we want government to regulate in this area or do we not? You know, and I think often in farming, we think we don't want regulation in those areas. But here's an area, say, with slash, where if it had been regulated, some of our farmers might have had a better time. And I think we get a bit black and white on regulation good, government bad, or whatever it is. So I feel like we have to have some more of these conversations about what's the role of government? What do we want from them? How? And I don't know the answer. I used to think I did. Like, the older I get, the less I know, do you know? But I think that we need that at the community level, you know. I think we need to be having that at the West Coast. I think we need to be having it on Tairawhiti. I think we need to be having it in Kaikanga, and we need to be having it down in Southland. And again, I don't know what the answer is, but I have faith that the wisdom of the crowd, if you get enough brains around it, that we can come up with some of these things.
A final question, again, for both of you. What do you see as the future for New Zealand dairy, both globally and closer to home? And also, what should farmers get excited about and what should they be mindful of?
Now, getting excited, I think the positive story is, you know, farmers have come through challenging times. There's been a lot of discussion around environmental regulation. I think in areas around fresh water quality improvements have been made. Climate change, we're having that discussion. So the domestic discussion, we've been having that discussion. Farmers are aware of what's coming at them and are preparing for that, and I think responding well. The good news story is, if we look back to what we've just been through in the last few years, is the dairy sector came through those tough economic times well. The dairy sector, you know, the fundamentals of supply and demand for dairy are still holding up pretty well. So I think the positive story is the chance to be getting a viable economic return for the dairy sector into the future is good. And what's good for dairy, the truism is still pretty good for the New Zealand economy. So even though we need to look at the footprint of the industry and make continual improvements and adjust to consumer expectations, when dairy is performing well, the economy performs well, and then other things can be done with that money coming in. So I think in that respect, the future for dairy is positive. The challenges are there, and there'll be a mixture of headwinds and tailwinds. There's clearly other products coming onto the market, and dairy will always need to position itself. But it's doing well to position itself, and I think grass-fed protein coming out of the New Zealand economy, there's a strong demand for that into the future and a strong future for it.
Yeah, I think, like, I come out of the meat industry, right? My first job was on a salmon oil line, and I've pretty much been involved in the meat industry most of the time. I think that there's a real opportunity for dairy to think about meat and to think about meat not just sort of, this is going to sound mean, I don't mean it quite as flippantly as this, but sort of meat as a byproduct. Meat's an actually really good product and you can get really good returns. And I'd like us to think about how we think about the total return to the farm, not just the return of dairy. And that also means addressing veal. You know, I think that, like, there's been some advances around the bobby calf area, but animal welfare is increasingly under scrutiny, not just globally, but also for our own local social license to operate. So my grandmother cooked veal, you know. I think that thing of, we might have to do some work to change some of the markets and some of the supply chain, and I'm not saying that'll be easy, but I think that there are some opportunities to think about better beef and dairy integration, including veal. I also, coming out of the meat industry, what I can say is that, you know, we've halved our production basically in 15 years and doubled our profit. And I think that there are some areas that we need to look at in the dairy industry where we might, like I said, it's messy and contradictory, where I don't think the whole industry has to go one way or the other. There is strong demand, which means that we play well in commodity space, and I don't think there's anything wrong with playing well in the commodity space. And on top of that, you know, I've just come back from the States where Alexandra Farms was selling their grass-fed organic regen milk for $12 a pint. And so, you know, I look at it and I go, what I'm really curious about from a farmer point of view is, how do I get you the best possible return? That's what my role in the meat company that I'm on, it's what I'm really interested in, is how does the farmer get the best return? And for some farmers, it will be volume. And for some farmers, it will be going down a really interesting niche. And I think we shouldn't assume that it's all the same answer, no matter where you are in the country, no matter what land you've got, no matter what your aspirations are. And so we have to not try and, like, beat each other up for taking different business strategies, because they both make sense in New Zealand.
Gosh, what a fascinating conversation. I was thinking about half an hour into it, we could just go full Joe Rogan and roll it for 3 hours. I think you guys could fill that time easy. Hey, but thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. I learned stuff, so I really enjoy that. Yeah, thank you.
Brilliant. I think farmers really enjoy it. You've got big brains and a lot to share, so thank you.
Great. You're welcome.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for tuning into Talking Dairy. A big thanks again to Melissa and Mark for those insights. As I mentioned earlier, keep an eye out for our Two Farmers Forum events in Karapiro, Waikato on Thursday, 27th of April, and Ashburton on Tuesday, 9th of May, for more on this topic and more. Lastly, if you haven't already done so, be sure to subscribe to the Talking Dairy podcast so you get notified when new episodes go live. Catch you next time.